Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Happy Shabbat to one and all. Kirk, it's been a long time since we've talked.
Oh, it's been hours.
it's been hours. I think we have Larry there in the 904. Is that you, Larry?
That's moi. How you doing?
That's moi. God, I'm doing great. How are you feeling?
Good. Everything's
any
good.
Drag out fights
really
here recently, or are you
suck.
Things been boring?
No, not really. Nothing to speak of. I had a little bit of a tiff with a covenant member because I had posted something about, you know, Yahweh asking for us to listen on many, many, many occasions, but never, ever, yeah. ever promoting the
never.
Idea of prayer.
Right.
And he got a little upset saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm not sure what it meant, but, you know, I mean, I do know for a fact that the Yahweh communicated with people in the Torah, and there were people that did ask him for things in the Torah. Not often, and not many times when they asked, did they get what they asked for, but, you know, there was no prayer in the Torah, not as we've come to know it, and I'm very anti-religious prayer, and I'm very pro-communicating, but I do know that communicating entails a lot of listening if you're to do it effectively, and that's just as a salesperson, you know that. I mean, that's where it's at.
Yeah, I remember that when I started in sales, I realized I didn't have the personality for it, so I just was awful at it. And I would make 25 sales cold calls a day, and get to the buyer maybe on one of the 20 or 25, and I was just terrible at it. And so
no, that alone made you top notch at it, by the way.
That's just the fact that I was willing to endure it. Yeah, I mean, I had a strategy.
Yeah.
I would go to the there's a map. I don't know if they have it in all places in the country, but in the Los Angeles County, which is where I was started in sales, they had what's called the Thomas Brothers map, and every page was a grid. So you'd page 54, and then you could do A7. And what I did is I took every person who attended every trade show in every category that I had sold products, and I came up, this was long before computers, so I had to do it manually, and I came up with a system where I then put on their a little card that I made for them what map page they were. So it was Tuesday. I was going to do section 43, starting with A1 and going down to F7. And that way, the drive between the calls was minimal, and I could make 20 to 25 cold calls a day, you know. So I was an expert at being told no. I got very proficient at being told no. And I was just awful. And then what I would do, though, is that there's certain larger buying offices that would have an open buying day. And they did it because if you were a guy like me and they didn't know who you were, they wouldn't give you an appointment. So the only way that you could see the buyer was on the open buying day, which was one day a month, and you would then have to sit out in the lobby and take your number and then get in. And I'd get in and make my pitch, and it was almost always just go away. So I came up with a different strategy. This is all getting to a point. And the strategy was that I would call and I would talk to the buyer over the phone, and I said, you know, I don't want to sell you anything. I want to do something that maybe hadn't happened in a long time. I always want to listen to you. I want you to tell me everything that's important to you. How
you're
evaluated. Yeah, just want to, you know, what kind of things you look for, how would you define success, what kind of things make you look good to your bosses. You know, I just want to take a half an hour of your time where the only thing you're going to hear from me is going to be questions. And I'm just going to listen. And then I did, and I got, and it was amazing how easy it was to get an appointment to listen to somebody. And then I would call them back after I had listened to them, and I said, you know, I listened to everything you said, and rather than try to sell you something, I went to my factories, and I told them what you were looking for. And I've got several factories that that would like to give you exactly what you asked for. And we meet. And I simply presented to them what they told me they wanted. You know something? I went from making about 25 cents an hour to making $2 million a year. All doing exactly the same thing, just doing it a different way. Because I I went from trying to sell them something to asking them for something to simply listening to what they had to say and then responding to them in a rational and reasonable way.
Well,
there's a lesson there. Yeah, and there's a lesson there.
Would you
say
that
relates to
probably
the ego? Do you think?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Do you think that is probably a better idea for us to listen than sit around and just blow smoke on you with words?
You know, there was a supermarket chain in Southern California called Ralph's. And Ralph's is a real premier supermarket chain, but they sold housewares products, which is what I was offering. And they had a really spectacular young buyer and merchandise manager. And he had never had anybody had done this before. And so when I explained to him, I said, you know, I don't think there's a single salesperson that's ever called on you that knows what you're looking for and what you need and what you want as well as you do. So if I just listen to what you want and need, I won't ever bother you by trying to sell you something that doesn't meet what you need. And I will only make an appointment if I can present to you exactly what you asked for. And, you know, that is something that is as a direct parallel to Yarrow. He knows a heck of a lot more about how we can get the most out of life than we do. He knows what's in our interest and what's not in our interest. And so we're a heck of a lot better off listening to what he has to say, and then once we understand what he's offering, we then can respond. And, you know, when you listen to the people that are asking him for things in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, for example, Abraham asked him for something. He says, I just don't get it. You keep on talking about an inheritance. I'm an old guy. I don't have an heir. I'm childless. And so what is an old guy who is childless going to do with an inheritance? So, I mean, I just flat out don't get it. God explained it to him.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask God about the things that he's interested in, and he will respond. But if you ask him about winning the lottery, scoring the touchdown, getting the date with the pretty girl, it isn't going to happen. If you ask him to save your country or to provide insights to your leaders, he's not only going to turn a deaf ear, he's going to look at you like you're an absolute ignoramus. You do yourself
and
more,
you
more
are.
Harm than good.
And you are
and
at that point. And you are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like even people threatening to stop seriously considering Yahweh's words because I use curse words. Even though I find that term kind of funny because, you know, a curse is something completely different. Like, I wish your mother dead or your wife dead or something. That's a curse, you know.
Right.
And actually, coming from me, those are kind of empty words. Because right now I'm wishing for $1 million to fall out of my ceiling, and that isn't happening. And I want Meredith Salinger to, you know, knock on my door, and that's not happening either. So, my curse words have nothing to do with much of anything, and I could pray for those things until I'm blue in the face, and it really won't matter because, again, Yahweh's going to go, you're an idiot. You're a total idiot.
Yeah.
Right. And I really don't want to approach Yahweh as a total idiot. I mean, I don't think he wants to spend time with people that are idiots, and I don't certainly don't want to be considered one of them. And that, rough words I had this week, and they weren't all that rough. And he was covenant, not going to break the name.
If you want to have a conversation with God, by all means, do not tell him what you want. Do not give him a to-do list. Isn't that the thing that most people do? That, you know, I pray for my country. I pray for my children. They give God a to-do list.
Right.
I mean, who in the world are we to give God a to-do list? I mean, he gave up his
stupid. I have no idea. I guess we know more than he does. See, that's where listening is a big, big, big time thing. And, you know, we're uncovering words here, and we're doing things. You realize, I mean, what we're doing is huge here. I mean, we're actually showing words that haven't been shown in, from what I can gather, thousands of years.
I think that's
and as far as I know, we're the only people doing it.
Yeah, I think it's been every bit of 2,000 years and maybe closer to 2,400 years since anyone's done this. Now, you'd say, well, absolutely, unequivocally, when Yosha was talking to his disciples and he made these connections for them, so long as he was speaking in Hebrew, he did exactly what we're doing. He was a lot better at it, a lot smarter at it, and more credible. But he did what we're doing. But with that exception, I don't think there was anybody from Malachi, with the exception of Yosha, all the way to today. I think there's this giant chasm of time where people have not taken what Yahweh said seriously. And since now that we have the tools and the opportunity and the desire to actually read what he said, to think about it, to make connections, to study it, to share it, to articulate it, to recite it, to read it, to translate it, I think we are in a position where we can do something that hasn't been done for a long time. And that's still a
couple thousand years. This is huge. You know, there's no reason ever to separate yourself from the truth because you may not like some personality within the group of people seeking the truth or sharing the truth. That's got nothing to do with it, if the truth be told. I mean, you know, to throw away something priceless over something stupid or mundane, that's just idiocy.
Yeah. I would ask you, Kirk, what would you tell, if you're going to have a conversation with God,
right?
Would you ask, is there something you would ask him for other than insight, maybe help you're struggling with a passage and you're looking for some insight, but other than that, are you going to ask him for anything, or is there anything in particular you're going to tell him?
I haven't really asked for anything other than the former.
I stopped asking for the former.
Help me understand this better, you know, that I can.
I won't even ask that anymore. Why would you ask? I don't ask you
every now and then. I get stumped on something, and I say, I just don't.
I get stuck.
Yeah. So I keep plowing away. I'm not even sure I say it consciously. I'm thinking, you know what, you're going to have to help me on this one. I can't figure this thing out.
Yeah, and I will say that subconsciously.
Yeah.
But
what
I find is two things. One is, do you think he's unaware of that?
No, he knows.
Do you think that you have to ask him to have him help you understand something?
Sometimes it's
voted
hard to just for me. You know,
That's right. Yeah, at that point, we're not really asking for anything.
We're just fumbling around with this thing.
That is the Set Apart Spirit's job. That's like saying, hey, Set Apart Spirit, would you please do your job?
For crying
out loud, would you do your job?
I can't remember who you're dealing with.
So, you know, I stopped asking that one.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of saying something to him, now, by the way, I will ask for things for every now and again. My youngest son is a member of the covenant. His overall situation, 1,000 miles from where I am, is important to me. And, I do talk to God about his situation. It's important. He's important to Yah as well, so we'll talk about that. But in terms of telling him things, I think that most of my... What are you going to do? You tell him, hey, you know, you're really cool. Okay, you're really smart.
I praise you.
Really dependable? No, I'm not going to do that.
I praise you. You don't like the I praise you thing?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
I don't. But what most of our conversation is, is when I finished translating something, or I get an insight, or I finished checking something, and and an insight dawns on me that is really what I think is interesting. I shared one last week,
mm-hmm.
that the creation of Chawa,
right.
is juxtaposed with the presentation of the tree of the perception of good and bad, right and wrong.
Right.
And the realization that those things are related, and that Yahweh specifically created Chawa so that Adam would never choose him by default.
Yeah.
He always had another option for companionship that was, you know, hot looking, fun to be around. That he always had another option. And he could have that option and Yahweh, or just that option, but he would always have someone to enjoy, to be around, that was like him. And the fact that was factored into the free will,
mm-hmm.
personally, that to me resonated with me, so that my experience in our communication for actually days after coming up with that realization was, I think, the kind of thing that he likes to hear.
Yeah. Well, it made me think about Robinson Crusoe. You know, if he was so excited on the island, he's all by himself. He's desperate.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movie that Tom Hanks was in, and he starts talking to Wilson, the
right.
soccer ball.
Coconut.
He gives him a name, because if you have nothing, you would gravitate.
You will go crazy.
You gravitate to something, because we need people. We need somebody.
Yeah, can you imagine if gave Adam nothing that he could talk to, I mean, the animals he couldn't talk to, and
yeah.
nothing at all, and then Adam ate from the tree, bewildered, beguiled by Satan,
mm-hmm.
and then he had nothing?
Nothing.
Oh.
Well, I mean, he would have gone out of the garden, and gosh, no, then he just, the whole thing would have declined very quickly because of the other human beings there. But
yeah.
He would have been so superior to them. They, you know, no contest.
Yeah.
As it turned out to be with Cain, but
right.
It's a horrible scenario. Every one of them are horrible scenarios.
Right. Yeah, it is true, and I think it is extremely important. It's one of the most important things that we can learn from studying Yahweh's testimony, is that he constantly asks us to be observant, to closely examine and carefully consider his testimony, and to listen to it. And he says that over and over and over again. In almost every discussion, he repeats it. And not once does he tell us, you know, what you need to be doing here is yibber-yabbering at me. I want your to-do list. I want to help you with everything.
I want your input on everything.
Yeah, I want your input. I want you. Now, it is interesting that we... I was dealing with the second chapter of Yeshayah, and there is a passage in there which Yahweh says come walk with me, and let's have a rational discussion. Now, a discussion means it's two-way conversation. But while there is some of that in terms of we read his testimony, respond to him, and that's pretty spectacular, what I think he's talking about is eternity, when we're going to go on a voyage of discovery through the universe together and explore things and talk about them. But at that point, you know, we are infinitely superior in every respect to what we are now.
We're probably worth having a conversation with by then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, from God's point of view, I think we're worth having a conversation
with.
Well,
I know. Now is fine.
Right.
Like a grown-up.
Right. But it's, you know, it's the difference is that I have lots of conversations with my 7-month-old granddaughter. Now, she thinks she can talk. And clearly, if you say words with the right expression on your face and the right tone, she'll respond very favorably to them. But it doesn't matter what the words are. It's the tone and the expression that matters. But still, we have conversations, and she responds back, and, you know, I do. But that's kind of like where we are now,
yeah.
versus the week that I spent with my youngest son, where, you know, we talked every waking moment. And the difference in the level of the conversation, I think, is kind of what God means when he says, you know, we're going to just go take a walk and have a rational discourse. Mm-hmm. But I think also, if recognizing who he is, what he's offered us in terms of information and teaching and guidance, a rational discourse with God would be to walk to him and then respond based upon what he's offered. Yeah. That would be a rational discourse.
And he says that over and over and over and over again. I don't care what they change the word shamar to. It still means to learn, carefully consider, and also respond.
Uh-huh. Right. And all shama means is to listen.
To listen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the reality of the whole thing, and I think we would be wise to do more listening and less talking when it comes to God. Now I know there's a lot of people that really enjoy their conversational time with God, and they're covenant members,
mm-hmm.
and I got no issue with that at all.
Yeah.
My conversational time is when I'm translating and thinking about it. So I've got mine, they've got theirs. That's the fact that we're different is great. And I don't think any of them present to God a to-do list.
No. I'm sure not so.
Yeah.
But have you ever sat out just in the park or something, and you're like the other day I was with my dog, and because I like to draw trees and all that kind of stuff. So I admire that. And sometimes you just go, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. I had stepped away from writing, translating, commenting, and I was doing some stuff outside that I needed to finish once I started, and there was like five thoughts that were really interesting as they related to the passage I just translated, and I was first excited about them. And then, my conversation was, help me transition what you just shared from short-term to long-term memory so when I get back to the keyboard, I can get all this in. Because this is really interesting stuff.
Yeah. You have to carry a little notebook around with you, as you keep aging. I know this. Everything on my mind,
I know.
Lots of legal pads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's and by driving in a car, I have lots of time to think and augment. Like for example, we were going through five, the horror of religion, and we were considering the horror's presentation of her objective of what she was stating and recognizing that everything she said, modeled Christianity 1,000 years before. In fact, 1,400 years really before the religion was imposed on the world, 1,050 years before Paul would write his first letter, and God through the proverb is articulating the very nature. Every aspect of Christianity is important.
Mm-hmm.
He's just laying it out there. That's pretty amazing.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Why didn't nobody pick this up? I mean,
it's
being rhetorical
now.
Not everybody has a good answer. They just don't care, I guess.
Yeah.
I think we're doing here hasn't been done in thousands of years. You know, I mean, I did put that. I put that right, in front of a woman who was espousing the virtues of the cross. I first explained where it came from. I explained where they added it. Then I showed her those words, everything stops at this piece of wood. I said, that sounds like you, doesn't it? I said, isn't that you? And she went right into defending her religion.
Right. The notion that a piece of wood or that a symbol is somehow responsible for your salvation is to just to write God out of the whole equation. Yeah.
I put her words against this
physical symbol. I mean, it's just so ludicrous. And what's the most amazing, too, is they don't even have the physical symbol right.
Oh, no, I know. I pointed that out, too.
That's the
old satanic sign in the world.
That she is so excited about didn't even exist until the sixth or seventh century. When it was changed from upright pillar to cross, crooks by the Roman Catholic Church. It didn't even exist.
The Roman Catholic Church has a dead god hanging on it.
Mm-hmm. A dead god.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Can you imagine anyone more foolish than walking around with a symbol that has a person being tortured?
Symbol right there on your chest.
Yeah,
it's the worship of death. It's straight up the worship. It's beautiful from a satanic point of view. Remember when you wrote that it's ingenious? It's almost beautiful from the Lord's perspective. These eggs dripped in blood. You said it's ingenious from a satanic point of view. The most ingenious thing he ever did was the crucifix. It's just genius.
Yeah. Well, this particular line summarizes the most brilliant thing ever postulated by Satan. For this reason, I came out to approach and meet you, calling out to you, longing to darken. I'm one too late. The sacrifice of being killed as a peace offering to finish and fulfill the promise of fellowship provided by me, the Almighty. The one day I fulfilled and completed and therefore finished once and for all my vows. That is the most brilliant thing Satan has ever come up with. He laid his lie right on top of the truth. Is it true that the sacrificial lamb was killed? Absolutely. But this is in first person. The sacrifice of being killed as the peace offering provided by me, the Almighty. It wasn't the Almighty that was killed. Just the physical body of the sacrificial lamb.
Yeah, so that's a lie.
Right,
but
and then the one day
has
what Christians envision. It's all about the cross. It ends right there. That's the one day.
In your first go-around, you know, where you're not looking at the voice change, okay? I didn't catch it. I didn't catch it, and I should have. Egypt was right there. That was the best clothing from Egypt. Egypt is, and Yasha, he says,
incense is an abomination to me, and we got
sure.
incense here.
Yeah, it's horrid.
But as you try to force it into Yahweh's voice, and you go, wait a minute, one day. And my vows are completely over with. None of the rest of it matters. What happened to Matzah and Shavuot and everything else.
Yeah, of course.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, he's right up to Kippurim and Sukkah fulfilling.
Proverbs 7:14. You know, after introducing Paul as the man with poor judgment that was leading the parade of nincompoops on behalf
right.
of the whore of religion, lurking
right.
outside of the window of his home. He then presents the fulcrum upon which Christianity stands, its cross.
Oh, yeah,
and
perfectly.
The death of its God, perfectly. Right here. I mean,
that's right.
And you say, how did everyone miss this? This has been available to us for 3,000 years. This was available to us when he was on that upright pole. And then when he fulfilled Pesach and...
It has to be seriously considered and chewed on, right? I mean,
right.
that's the whole thing. Most of the people all of the people I knew that even cared at all, they were reading the whore's material straight out of the, book named after the two sun goddesses, Holy and Biblia. You know, the ones we're told
right.
not to read, we're told not
right.
to consume those words. There's a reason for that, because it gets us thinking along a line where, we can just blow right by things.
And I would ask people, where does God have a... First of all, where does God ever speak positively of being with the Lord, of Bel?
Never.
Of Babel,
Never.
Which is Babylon. So... It shares the consonant root with, in fact, the same letters, with Babel, Babylon, which is the whore of Babylon. That's the birthplace of religion. It's the most disastrous thing in all of human history. Do you think that he's going to name his book after Babel Confusion?
No. No,
yes.
No.
I mean, there's a 0% chance of that. That calling
or a sun goddess.
The Bible.
I mean, we all know, how all things occur.
We all know. In fact, I almost wish I didn't know that that Biblios was based upon the name of a town in Egypt that grew papyrus, and it was and that the town in Egypt was named after Biblia, the Egyptian goddess. And so, when the town in Phoenicia imported the papyrus and started growing it, and that they used then the papyrus to replace parchment for writing, and therefore the parchment for writing was called Biblos, and they started making books out of it as opposed to scrolls because the way the parchment laid flat as opposed to rolling up. And so that was the derivation. And so if you just take it back and you say, well, the name of the town is based on the name of a Egyptian goddess. That's all true. I wish I didn't know that.
Yeah, and even holy, though. Holy.
But you read the reason I wish I didn't know that is because when you if you really have your mind open and you look, and if you look at Bible, you either see Babel, which is confusion,
or
but
Babylon.
It's the whore of Babylon. It's the very essence of satanic religion, of Christianity, because God makes the direct connection in Revelation and in Yashaya between Babylon, Satan, the whore of religion, Pauline Christianity, and Roman Catholicism. It's all there and undeniable. The likelihood that God chose Bible, but it's the thing that he uses over and over again to describe the worst possible influence. It's akin to changing Yahweh's name to the Lord. Changing Yahweh's name to the Lord and changing his Torah, Nabi, and his Mizmor to Bible. Exactly the same thing.
Right,
it's really despicable. It is.
Yeah, even worse than that. I mean, it's holy Bible. I mean, holy. The consort to Krishna. The most important sun festival in India. I mean, that's just the truth. You know, so we sit there, we got a book literally, really named after two sun goddesses, don't we?
Right.
And shares Babel and Bebel and with Bel. You know, and people are running around with this, with their little concordances. I mean, this is as far as they go.
Oh, by the way, if you're dealing with the Christian New Testament, which is the only part of the Babel they read, if you're dealing with it, then it's happily named. I do not have a problem with Paul's letters, Hebrews, most of Acts, and even some of the letters. I don't have a problem with them being called Bible. Perfect name for them.
That's what it's promoting.
Confusion. Exactly.
It's like it's an ongoing beating, but you can't pull people off these things. They feel like they have to own one. And I'm telling people, you go to that polluted mess, and this is what's happening. You go to that polluted mess and pull out your Strong's and then go to the most recent corruption and go, yep, that's what that means. It's accurate.
Come on. And, by the way, I use Strong's a lot.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and you go to the oldest.
And the reason I use Strong's is that Strong's does a decent job, at least, I'd say, 70% of the time, of linking directly to the actionable root of the word. Now, for the most part, I've learned how to do it independently. But just in case I missed it, I'll always... And by the way, Strong's not right. When they go to the actual root of a word, there's a lot of times they're not right. For example, if you go to Strong's and you look for the root of Bereth, you get Bana. It isn't Bana. I mean, it's obvious that the root of Bereth is Baef. mean, it's just so obvious.
Yeah, obvious. Yeah.
Couldn't be more
obvious. I don't even do translations, and that's obvious to me.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
And, you know, Bona's a fine word. I don't have a problem with Bona. Bona means to build a family home, to rebuild something. To build in the family name, that sort of thing. So I don't have a problem with Bona. Bona's a fine word. It's just not the basis of Big Red Covenant. So, but, you know, I view Strong's as a... Oh, the other thing Strong's does a good job of, and the reason I still use it, is that Strong's does a more accurate transliteration than do any of the other sources. For example, if a word really has the Hebrew C in it, Strong's will show it with a C, where every other source will show it with an S. If there's a wa in the spelling, now, you know, I've gotten to the point where I read Hebrew now, so I just look at the word and I spell it based upon the Hebrew spelling. But you know, if you're curious, if it's a, and you're less lazy about it, you just go to Strong's, and it will provide the basis of the spelling with all of the Hebrew letters. And you know, if there's a wa in it, they're going to have the wa in it. Strong. So there's some advantages, but it's like every tool. You have to know what it's good for and what it's bad for. And James, I know you did a lot of translation. When you did it, what you found, I'm certain, is that Strong's first response, 100% of the time, is how the word was rendered in the King James, right?
Yeah.
The other thing is that the King James was not a translation of the Hebrew. There wasn't even a sniff of Hebrew in the King James. There wasn't any Hebrew scholar. There wasn't any manuscript.
Yep.
You know, it was a revision of five previous revisions of a translation of the Latin Vulgate. And all the King James was is a revision five times over of a Latin to English translation. And it was, as you know, even the Latin Vulgate was Jerome.
Just a compilation of old Latin.
Jerome didn't read Hebrew. He didn't have access to Hebrew texts. He didn't read Hebrew. He was translating old Latin into the popular Latin of the day. And he used the when the Vulgate wasn't completely. When the old Latin wasn't completely comprehensive for him, he would look at the Septuagint. But by the 3rd century, the Septuagint was so badly flawed and so corrupted, and it was a Greek translation, so it didn't help a whole lot.
Way distant.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, the other thing that Strong's is really good for is the Strong's numbering system is virtually every lexicon is keyed to. So you can give someone that you're trying to explain something to, you can give them the Strong's number, and they can open up any dictionary or lexicon and be able to find the word very quickly.
Yeah. One of the things that Strong's does not do well, though, is translation prioritization. They do a very poor job of that. And by prioritization, there are words where the primary definition of the word, for example, might be to respond, and afflict, would be the 12th most important definition, the 12th most likely definition of the word. And Strong's will just intermix them. Where there are where better, more disciplined lexicons will provide a prioritization of them. But, for the most part, all you got to do is look at the root of the word, look at the actionable root, look at words that are similarly written, and there isn't, study it in context and you'll find a translation of it. But if you're going to use one lexicon, that's like the guy with one watch. He's always thinks he knows what time it is. The guy with two watches is trying to compromise between the two, and the guy with three watches, he's clueless. Yeah. So, You got to be. It's not that hard, but you have to be disciplined. You have to know what the tool is good for, and what it's not good for.
But beyond that, yeah. You have to be thoughtful. I mean, look. I've read, there's a lot of people I know. Kirk, you said you've gotten good stuff out of Jeff Benner's work. Maybe you have, JB, I don't know. But I do know this. I've read his commentaries, and I know he doesn't know nor understand Yahweh. I know this for a fact. He doesn't know him.
Don't read his
commentaries. What's that?
I went to his site about 10 years ago. I went to his site about 10 years ago. And I went to his site about 10 years ago for a singular purpose. I wanted to see if I could get a font that enabled me to type the closest variations of Paleo Hebrew. And he did provide, to his credit, you could download the fonts from the site. I then read what he had to say. And it's just awful.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't know Yahweh, and thus I don't
know. Doesn't even have a clue.
I don't care about his material.
It didn't take more than 20 minutes to realize I'm not going to gain anything here. This is not going to be helpful at all.
That's my point. So, it's not just your use of lexicons, or it's not just one's use of lexicons. It's also understanding the mitzvah. I mean, that's why we're encouraged to reason the mitzvah. It's not a bunch of obeying. It's to understand Yahweh's nature. And if we don't know Yahweh's nature, why would we listen to somebody who doesn't even know Yahweh's nature? Because they don't know Yahweh. And thus, their translations are going to be, like you just pointed out in the Strong's, they're going to take the low road. It's the low road. It's always the low road.
Well, for example, if mitzvah was a command, and
there goes free will.
And since Yahweh is constantly telling us that we should shamar mitzvah, if you were a PFC and a full-blown colonel tells you to walk across the street there and shoot that guy,
he's not asking you to consider his words. He's asking you to go do it.
Right? Yeah, he is absolutely not asking you to carefully consider or closely examine what he has said. He just wants you to go over and do what he said. Don't think about it.
And there are repercussions and consequences to not listening.
Right.
And there we have the religion, don't we? We have the religion of the military.
And in fact, I never even thought of that before. You want absolute proof that mitzvah cannot be a translated command, is that it is constantly, it's constantly putting it, the verb that precedes mitzvah, the vast preponderance of the time is shamar. Closely examine and carefully consider. No one ever asks you to closely examine and carefully consider a command. An order is something you simply do without thinking. That means that somebody who has more authority than you in a non-free will environment has told you what to do, you just do it. Thinking about it is counterproductive, and under
that's
those.
That's a very good point. There, you just put the apostrophe on mitzvah. So anybody that thinks it's a command at this stage is completely that's listen to this. They've lost their mind. They've lost their mind.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, with the advent of free will, which is what the tree represented, after free will, anybody that calls it a command has lost their mind.
Right.
I mean, really.
Well, that's why I think that the fact that the tree is presented to Adam. And by the way, when we finish the thought, then I'm going to go to the by the way. The fact that Chawa and the tree are part of the same conversation in the same breath so fabulously underscores free will. You couldn't be in a more free will environment than God said, I'm going to give you a companion that you're really going to like. And also, I'm going to give you everything you can eat, and you can even eat from that tree over there. But if you do eat from that one tree, you're going to be expelled and dispatched, and you're going to die. But this is the point I want to make. Did God ever plead with Adam not to eat from the tree?
Nope.
No.
Did he ever plead with him never to listen to Satan?
No.
Did he ever plead with him to maintain this relationship and spend the majority of his time with him?
Nope.
Ever plead with him to pray to him? Did God plead with him in any way, shape, or form?
Not that we never.
No. And that is essential. He didn't plead with him. And he never gave him a command. Even the instruction on the trees in the garden, he said, man, he even has a call, the Hebrew word for eat. It's a call. Eat. Man, knock yourself out. Eat whatever you want, whenever you want, wherever you want. I'm a call. That means eat on steroids, man. Go for it.
But if you eat that, understand this.
In the same breath, it's and there is the tree of the understanding, the discernment of that which is right and wrong. If you eat of that tree, you're going to be dispatched and die. God did not say don't eat from the tree. Didn't say don't touch the tree. Didn't say don't look at the tree. In fact, it's interesting, too, that the instruction on if you eat from that tree, do you think it was written in the perfect or the imperfect?
Imperfect.
Imperfect.
Imperfect, absolutely. Make a habit of eating from that tree. You're going to die. You're going to be dispatched and you're going to die. It's a powerful underscoring of that everything was...
Not just that. He never even said, don't listen to Jawa. Don't listen to her.
I'm going to create her for you, and it's going to be a really attractive alternative for you. So this choice to act upon these instructions that I'm providing and to maintain the relationship therein, it's like, again, like Noah, we'll provide him instructions, and Noah had a choice. He could disregard the instructions, or even if he had a choice, he could have changed the instructions. Say, I don't want to make a glue lamp that big. I don't want to make the ark that big. It's just too damn much work. It just that he wouldn't have prevailed. And the same thing was true with the Adam. Here are the instructions. Do with them whatever you want. But, boy, when the Creator goes to such an extreme to give you a choice, for anybody in their right mind to say, well, that was a command, and we are commanded, and that we really don't have free will, you just got to be absolutely out of your mind. You're not using...
You know what's really funny? The people pushing the command point of view all work for Satan. I mean, they all do.
And they're the same ones that render the Hebrew word shema, listen, obey.
Mm-hmm.
You think that God chose the name, because he chose the name. Did he think he chose the name Baal, which means the Lord? Do you think he chose the Lord for Satan because the title he really wanted?
No. It was a descriptive term. It was descriptive
right.
of
if
him.
If this is the adversary, I'm going to choose a name for the adversary that shows how adverse the adversary is to who I am. And the adversary, the Lord, obey, own, control, submit to.
Now you're getting into Yahweh's nature because you've thought about it, because you've chewed the cud, because you think about it. And, this is what's sorely lacking in religion, in religious material, in the religious thought process, in all of it. It's so irrational. I mean, it's the height of irrationality. I mean, it really is.
So we need to think about words. For example, in Proverbs 7:21, speaking of the whore, she guides him, speaking of Shaul, Paul, and persuades him to reach out. To reach out means the Hebrew version of it's Natah, Hebrew version of the Greek apostle. She guides him and persuades him to reach out. With the magnitude, the abundance of her persuasive words, her fetching doctrine, her possessive, and readily accepted. With her smooth and seductive lips and thus language, she compels him. So it's not just that Yahweh uses words to guide us, to instruct us, but so does Satan. And so, if you want to look at...
Well, I mean, you just described what they all want at the circus there, too. The smooth-talking, convincing preacher.
Right.
That's what they all want. They all talk
persuasive, by the way.
Persuasive.
You know, this Hebrew word, which is barav, lekach. It's interesting that it doesn't just mean persuasive, because God never tries to persuade us. It's fetching doctrine. I mean, that was the appeal of Christianity. Yahweh came with this a proposal that says, all right, if you listen to what I have to say, if you closely examine and carefully consider the instructions that I have provided to you, and then based upon them, you respond in a rational way once you come to understand what it is that I'm offering and asking in return, then you'll come to know me and you'll be part of my family. That requires an enormous investment of time. You've got to prioritize the relationship. Paul comes along with this fetching doctrine, and he says, no, you don't need any of that. Just believe me. If you believe what I'm telling you, that's it. Don't need to think. Don't need to read. Don't need to learn. Don't need to invest any time. Don't need to know squat. Just believe me, and you're saved. And this idea of, the world was scary, and death looked scary. And so if a guy came to you and said, listen, all you got to do is believe. God himself told me that if I tell you, and I'm authorized by God, all you got to do is believe, and you'll be saved. And you're going to go directly to heaven, and the only thing that's required of you is for you to believe. Believe what? Believe me. Is there any proof? Well, don't worry about that. It's not about knowing. It's about believing. That's pretty fetching, isn't it?
It's not just that. There's one other thing that, this description entails to me.
Mm-hmm.
When I started learning Yahweh's words, and I started sharing those words with other people, it was not like trying to talk somebody going into a church. It was something completely different.
Right.
I was saying, open up your ears. I wasn't saying, come follow this man in this building anymore.
Correct.
My perspective changed. Okay? Mm-hmm. And part of what, this kind of, describes to me are the people out evangelizing, doesn't it? I mean, it really does to me.
Now, you know that I fly airplanes. So there's a... Let's use that analogy. There's two flight schools out there. There's the old school flight school. And it says, in 40 hours of flight time and 40 hours of classroom time and a commitment on your part to read this 1,000-page book and memorize much of what's in it. After reading the 1,000-page book, we're going to test you on it to make certain that you know it. And then after the 40 hours of flight time and the 40 hours of classroom time, which, by the way, you're going to pay me for, after doing all of those things, then we're going to have an evaluation as to whether or not you understood and can act upon the instruction that we've provided. That's the old school flight school. I went to that one. And then they say, if you want to level up, then it's another 100 hours of training. And another 100 hours of study and classroom time, and a much more difficult evaluation as to whether or not you understood this, so that you can go fly based upon charts when you can't see out the window. And we'll call that an instrument rating. Now, that's the old school, flight school. There is the new school, the New Testament of flight school. You go there, and all they say is, believe you can fly. And
you're
an airplane. You go up. We're going to give you the keys. You go take this airplane off. All you got to do is believe you can fly.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Who are you flying with? Yeah. So I would like
you
to
better hope
you,
it's a drone.
Of the people who went to the New Testament of flight schools, the New Covenant of flight schools, where all you have to do is believe. You don't have to know anything about communication. You don't have to know anything about navigation. You don't have to know anything about charts. You don't need to know anything about the airplane and how it operates. All you got to do is believe you can fly. I believe. And you take that airplane off. What percentage of those who do that are going to survive the experience?
None.
Zero.
None. Yeah, no. You want to know? You want to know what faith is? Yeah, yeah. And they got faith too. Because I'll tell you what faith really is. Here's faith.
Yeah.
Faith is you walk, you fill up a jumbo jet, the Concorde. You fill up the Concorde. Then you all go to the middle of the aisle and you draw straws to see who's going to fly it.
Yeah,
there's faith for you. That's faith.
Yeah. You know. But that what is the difference between the old version of flight and Yahweh's Torah and the new covenant of flight schools where all you have to do is believe? What is the difference between that analogy and Yahweh's Torah?
Well, one takes effort and thought and time, and one takes an emotional
One results in an extraordinary skill that empowers you to travel and to do things, and that is an extraordinary skill that you're competent to operate. And the other one gets you killed.
Well, you know, the preachers do practice very hard and learn their newfound skill from Paul. They learn how to deceive. So, I mean, there's a little fly in the ointment, but
how many pastors do you think have spent 1% of their time doing what we're doing in terms of trying to accurately and completely translate Yahweh's testimony and then think about it?
None. If you talk
none.
That's
zero.
It, no.
Zero. Right, zero. I mean, how much time do you think that the Pope, Bergoglio, has spent analyzing the Torah prophets and Psalms and comparing it to Pauline doctrine?
They don't teach.
None.
They ain't gonna help.
None.
Zero. Absolutely. Not a... Yeah.
But you would have thought that some of these theologians, because the one that you talked to at the university when you were talking with Jerry Falwell, he knew what you were talking about.
Oh yeah, he knew that Christmas and Easter were Babylonian and Sunday worship was Babylonian, that God had a name and that to negate the value of his name was a horrible thing to do, and that there was no Jesus and that Christ was not a last name and there was no Trinity and that it was Babylonian. We went through the whole list and that Lord
is
they don't
know what God's
name and title. He knew all that. There was,
the best,
was anything I told him that he wasn't aware of. He knew it. But his conscience was dysfunctional.
Yeah. He's totally
well,
clear.
You know, that's,
yeah.
They
don't, and by the way, he was a really nice man.
Well, but by the way, they talk about belief. And see, in his belief system, because he didn't understand, you know, he didn't even understand probably that this piece of wood, you know, that Yahweh talks about here was going to be the final salvation tool in Christianity. He obviously didn't understand prophecy, because if he understood prophecy, he would understand what we are doing is real. You know, we're back in old flight school here. Mm-hmm. And then what he was doing was just helping perpetuate a religious myth in order to make a living and sort of be a good guy while he does it.
Now
that's it.
That's
what he was doing.
Or any of you guys.
Okay.
Is the story of the flood and of Noah receiving instructions from Yahweh and acting upon them and engaging, following Yahweh's instructions, is that prophecy?
Yes.
Happened.
Yes.
Happened 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Well, when he opens up and he talks about deep ocean water, and then you find the Burkle crater, and you figure out that happened during Noah's lifetime, I mean, that takes prophecy. Somebody had to be there, you know,
to
know that.
It's prophecy. Even though it was recorded
in the past.
1400 BCE, so it was recorded long after it happened.
Right. Nobody then could have been alive.
It's totally accurate.
No, nobody then, even when it was reported, could have been alive.
Yeah, it's just like was the transition from Babylon when Daniel was given the history of mankind and told that Babylon, which was the most powerful country in the world, was going to be ravaged by and conquered by Media Persia, and that the country that actually defeats Babylon, which would just be unbelievably mind-blowing, that country is going to be defeated by Greece.
The Greeks
didn't even exist as a country at the time. Barely existed. They were just fledgling. And that
they were loosely. They were a bunch of loosely.
Absolutely. 500 BCE did not exist. That was Rome. And that Rome was going to defeat Greece, which was going to defeat Persia, which was going to defeat Babylon. And so he was told this. And by the way, then he goes to the future and he talks about even our future, how that Roman, the Imperial Rome, is going to morph into the Roman Catholic Church. But when he's talking to him about the conquest of Babylon, which now happened 2,500 years ago, is that prophecy?
Yes.
Of course, yeah.
Well, you know what? What we're reading is prophecy. He's describing Sheol, what he'll bring to the world, and describes
and
it perfectly.
How he'll do it.
How in the hell can you blow by this? I mean, really, I'll be honest with you. I think the prophecy about Sheol is some of the most astounding prophecy I ever read.
I think
it is astounding to me.
Yeah,
I love it. Yeah, I love it.
Like,
at the end of this, I mean, this.
Yeah, and
right on.
It's true that, Kirk, when you were reading this, and when I made the, you know, first I was right and I translated this in the Horus voice, and then I was wrong and I went back and tried to translate it in Yahweh's voice, and then I said, oh, that's stupid. That's impossible because then you just deal with all these things. And then when you came across and you said, wait a minute, one day, first of all, I died as the Almighty and I fulfilled my vows in one day. Can't be. And then that transfers it back into the Horus voice for certain. But then when you realize that the opening line of the whore is the basis of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
that God died.
Right.
And that everything, full stop, that one day when God died.
Yeah,
that is the basis
of
the religion. Right.
It's a beautiful plan. That's not it.
Well, yeah, which is absolutely insane. Right over in the Mizmor, it said, I did not give you over to death.
Yeah.
That's, again, you know, you get back into Christian tradition, which is that all souls are what? Immortal, right? I mean, they either go to hell or they go to what they call heaven. I don't even like that word.
Yeah, the wages, a little sign of just outside of my house here, somebody put in the front lawn, the wages of sin is death.
Now, there's the real reality of it.
Yeah, sure. You got it right. Now, carry that to its logical conclusion.
Right.
And sin would be, you know, running off to church on Sunday. Talk about missing the mark of the Torah. You know.
So here it is. She guides him to be an apostle, to reach out with the magnitude of her fetching doctrine and with her smooth and seductive language. She compels him. She entices and seduces him. God doesn't do compelling. God doesn't do seductive. Just doesn't do that. That is not his thing. But I will guarantee you, Christianity is seductive.
Oh gosh,
and those pastors, they're smooth talkers.
Pretty as
James Baker. Yeah, I mean, they're
great art, great stained glass. Are you kidding? Beautiful building.
Now speaking about Paul again, he follows after her right away, instantly and openly, like a dumb castrated steer, like a stupid cow going to the slaughter, like. He was wearing as a woman would wear, a tinkling bangle clasped to her ankle, which serves as a fetter. As just a foolish moron. So when Paul was struck on the road to Damascus, And, you know, of course, it's always interesting. You get Christians never, you know, are incapable of processing this. But you've got Yosha's example. He causes the lame to walk and the blind to see. And the first two things that that happened to Paul is that he was ambulatory and now he's lame. Falls down, can't get up, and he was he could see, and then he was made blind. So I could say, okay, we have the opposite going on here. Think about this, folks.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Yosha. Appreciate you.
Yeah.
Very
okay,
nice.
There you go.
Yeah.
But Paul, he hears this booming voice, and he his first comment is, "Who are you, Lord?"
Yeah, and he knew the word Baal.
First
he knows
thing
what
he
Baal means.
Who are you, Lord?
Mm.
And then he, the Lord tells him, yeah, I am Ayusu, who you are persecuting. Now, think about that even for a moment. Because right here, you know, we're told that he's going to follow her like a dumb castrated steer. And he's going to follow her instantly and openly. That Paul is. So Paul then claims that he got this answer, and the first thing that Ayushu said is that the Spirit of the Lord, who has just blinded him and made him lame, took him, you know, more than a week to recover. First thing he said is, "Why are you prosecuting?" So if you were thinking, okay, now the real Ayushu, did he ask Pontius Pilate, "Why are you prosecuting me?"
No.
Nope.
Did Pontius Pilate actually have him flogged and crucified, which I would consider persecution?
Yeah.
He did, didn't he? So
yeah.
Here is Rome. Mm-hmm. The Roman leader actually tortured him by whipping the skin off of his legs and back and chest. And then nailed him to a death stake. Now, I would call that persecution. And he
yep.
did so for no crime. And did Yosha ever say, right, why are you persecuting me? Did he ever ask that question?
No.
No. Did he ever complain to Rome?
No.
That
no.
I don't want you to persecute me. No. So here's puny Paul. Puny Paul. Never touched him, never seen him. Do you think that the first words out of Yosha's mouth are, "Hey, puny Paul,
why are you persecuting me?
Hey, lowly and little.
Lowly man."
Yeah. Now, okay, in terms of 1 to 10 importance with God, you know, I'm a .001. And yet, when I agreed with Yahweh that I would do my best to expose and condemn Islam, and then later to expose and condemn Paul, and then later just simply to reveal what he had to say, I got a promise that Yahweh would provide however many of his malach were necessary to A, make certain that I never stumbled when engaged in this process, B, that my home was never made vulnerable by the advocates of the poisons that I was exposing and condemning, and made a promise that I was going to be empowered, that I was going to live a long life, and that I would never be threatened in all of this. So does Yahweh, based upon the 91st Psalm, and the 91st Psalm exists for everybody. He didn't just say, "Hey, this Psalm only... works for this numbskull Gentile that's going to be born 3,000 years from now?" Or was it just an open-ended promise like everything else he says?
Yes, open-ended.
Okay.
So
let's just say that you're a numbskull Christian and you're thinking that, well, you know, Paul is out there murdering, by his own admission, murdering the followers of the way. In fact, he was going to the synagogues, which means they were Torah observant, Yehudim, going to the synagogue and trying to get them to blaspheme, which means trying to get them to say, Yahweh or Yosha, which would be blasphemy. So he was going to the synagogues, which means they were Torah observant, and he was trying to get them to say Yahweh or Yosha. So they recognized Yahweh as Yosha by being Torah observant, and he went and was killing them. Now, do you think the 91st Psalm applied to them, the people that Paul allegedly claimed to be killing?
Well, he should have.
So,
yes, I do.
So, do you think that if Yahweh says he's in the business of honoring his promises, and he gave the 91st Psalm, and these people came to know him, they were Torah observant, and they were relying on him, 91st Psalm applied to them, didn't it?
Sure.
So if Yahweh had them as part of his family, he's going to keep Paul from being able to harm them, just as he has kept Muslims and irate morons from harming me, correct?
Right.
So is there any chance whatsoever that Paul actually killed any one of the Torah observant followers of
at a hope and shield?
No, you're right. There isn't even a chance. He's just running around claiming
things. You can't even extrapolate to this idea that he was badgering the followers of the way, therefore that indirectly he was persecuting him, and he's asking him why he's doing that. A, if he was doing that, he would know the reason. And B, he already has a method of protecting his family. Read the 91st Psalm. It's right there.
Well, you know, let me say this, though.
So it could not have happened.
Let me lay this out.
Conversation.
There were plenty of Nabi that were killed. I mean, they were murdered,
mm-hmm.
you know, by the religious class. So I take something different away from it. Yeah, I mean, you have your personal agreement. You know, I don't want my home. I don't want my... But, you know... You know, for them to come up and kill a covenant family member, they can do it. They have,
by the way, very few.
You know,
it's not actually a lot. Actually,
no,
it's not a lot.
I'm saying it's a lot.
But it's not a lot. And the ones that happened were never struck and taken out young. They've lived. I mean, you look at Yashayah. I mean, Yashayah began his prophecy, and he was a grown man at the time, probably in his 40s or 50s, and he began in 745 BCE, and he went all the way up to did this over like 40 years. So I see he would have been 85, 90
years old,
95 years old.
Yeah, I'm not. They did him a favor. Yeah, I'm not saying that either. Okay.
Right.
I'm just saying that it's not like they can't kill him.
I did not ask. I have never asked for Yahweh to protect me from Muslims, from the threats. I wasn't interested in that. What I was interested in is my family being protected. And so, if it's the extension is Yahweh's family, he's going to protect his family. He has a means to do it.
All of the prophets that were killed, they all finished their course that they were put on first. They didn't stop them.
But the only guy that started young was Jeremiah started young, but then he went on for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, you know, it's the killing the prophets. They killed the two greatest prophets, but. And one they took out young, Yahusha,
mm-hmm.
and one they took out old, Yashayahu. It's kind of interesting, of course, that Yashayahu and Yahusha are same name, just in different order.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, those are the two. Yeah. So it's not common, but this idea is that Paul didn't have a clue who the voice was, and the voice, but yet he immediately acquiesced to the voice's will. This is prophetic. And he did it stupidly, like a dumb castrated steer. And the term that is shore that is used here to speak of this domesticated animal. What was the line that Paul quoted after he's saying, "Why are you persecuting?" What was the next line that he used?
Done with the Dionysus.
You betcha.
Yeah.
is difficult for you to kick against or rebel against the goat. And the goat is the sharp stick that we used to what? What was the F? To dub animal, right? I mean, that's how much detail Yahweh has in his prophecies. He said he followed like a dumb animal. What did he claim? Difficult for you to rebel against the goat means that you're going to go along like a dumb animal. That's the level of detail Yahweh has in this prediction. Right down to the quotation that is going to be used in this particular case. Pretty astounding.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we go from that to the next line. That was 7:22. He says, until an arrow, a projectile shot from a weapon, something that separates and cuts off, pierces that which is essential to life, he is like an early bird, impetuously rushing directly towards a plot which ensnares. He does not realize that, truthfully, the plot is against his own soul. So here's Paul. He's, you know, he's going off and he's doing this. It wasn't until he was at the precipice of death that Paul finally figured out that, you know, I've been abandoned by everybody. I'm miserable. This didn't turn out so good. And it's the same thing with virtually all Christians. Oh, man, they're ready to go. Man, oh, yeah, I've done my prayer. I'm going to have the last rites. But, man, when it comes right down to it, scared to death. That's when they realize, you know, I don't have it. I don't. I'm afraid to die. And it's, so it's right
if
up to that last moment.
If that was not so, why did we always pray? Why, it seems like every time you turn around, you're praying, forgive me my sins, all the time.
Right.
You know?
All the time. Don't forget. Yeah, you don't die without that last one there.
Yeah.
So it's not in film that they're actually dying, that they and their soul leaves them, that they actually realize, well, I was wrong, that whole plot was actually against me, and that is truthfully against their soul. And now, my children, Yahweh says, choose to actually listen to and approach me. Listen, Shema. Actually listen to me. Shema. So now, my children, choose to listen to me and elect to pay attention, accepting what you hear is true, and of your own volition, actively and appropriately respond. This is Wa Kasab. So listen to me. By the way, listen to me. Call imperative active.
Mm-hmm.
The imperative mood expresses volition. That's why I was choose to listen to me.
Right.
The imperative mood expresses second person volition. Choose to listen to me. Call means literally, actually, genuinely listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Active. And don't do this passively. Be engaged.
No, listen with attention.
And elect to pay close attention, accepting what you hear is true, and of your own volition, actively and appropriately respond. Wa Kashab. This was written in the Hifl stem, where the subject, who is God, enables the object, which is his children, to participate, that was hard for me to say, to participate in the process. So he's saying that if you pay attention, I'm going to help you through this process of approaching me, of actively responding. You're not going to be out there all by yourself. Once you've genuinely listened, you've paid attention, you've accepted what you've heard is true, at that point, I'm going to help you through the response.
Well, you know, he used two words here, Shema and Kasab, both meaning to pay close attention, so he said it
right.
Twice. So obviously that's the emphasis. Anytime you hear it twice.
Right. Yeah, Kasab means
to pay attention.
They have
the
same applied to find the same meaning here.
Yeah.
There goes commands. There's no command there. There's, you know,
right.
you got to elect to do this. I mean, all relationships are real. Come on,
right.
Guys.
Both,
I mean,
both the Shema, which means to listen, intently to listen, was written in the imperative. And also to be alert and attentive and respond was written in the imperative. The imperative is the mood of volition. I mean, you look up at any Hebrew grammar, and the first thing you'll read, imperative mood. It is the mood of volition. That's where the speaker is telling whomever they're talking to, under the auspices of free will, it's your choice, but this is what I hope you choose. That's what this means. And pay attention and appropriately respond. It was written not just in the imperative mood, but in that hiphil stem, which means that God is enabling us, is empowering us once we listen to what he says, just by listening, God is empowering us to respond. Even helps us pay attention, to be attentive while we're doing it, to be diligent in our listening. Then he says, and respond what? Respond to what Paul has said? Respond to what? Statements and promises, words.
Words of my mouth.
Yeah. The words of my mouth. The words. Where would you find the words of his mouth? Torah, the Navi, and Mizmor. Right?
Both of the tough ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's it. Full stop. Not hard. When he said this in 1000 BCE, what existed at that time?
1000 BCE?
Torah? No. Nabi? Mizmor.
Yeah.
In fact, the Mizmor were just coming into their existence.
That's barely coming.
And of the prophets at this point, you'd had, you know, not a lot of them, but, you know, Shamuel was a prophet.
Yeah.
And so your Moshe was absolutely a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a few, but not even a lot. So,
well, it's interesting. Let me just add one little thing for the picture people like me. The pay, just a simple word of mouth, you know, strong with a mouth, was obviously words. And it's also words that create the person to it. The hay is the person standing up saying, behold. So is everything positive in that?
Right. Yeah, I mean, how hard is it to translate "hey" as mouth when it's mouth and then a person looking up, holding what
wow.
It means then.
How about him?
Yeah, it's drawn as a mouth.
Standing, by the way, not bowing.
Yeah, right, standing.
The words. So no command there either, Larry. You can use that one.
Yeah, no command. Yeah, you've got these two. You know, choose. Both of them written in the imperative. The imperative is the mood of volition.
Yeah, well, what's this voice when I'm being commanded? What the hell is going on here?
Ain't none.
Yeah. No, I liked your military version. That was actually beautifully thought out. It was beautiful. I really did like that because, you know, I've been in command and control structures, and I can tell you they're not asking you to thoughtfully consider anything at all. In fact, they don't want you considering anything at all.
You know, it's interesting. At peak, you know, I probably had a couple of thousand employees at my last business. I never gave an order. I mean, you go up command and control, man. I had the highest title. I had the title. I owned the shares. I had the title of CEO and chairman of the board. That empowers you in a business structure to give orders, commands. Never gave one.
That's essentially a five-star general.
Yeah, never gave. That is in business as a five-star general. Never once gave one. I figured that if I could explain what we were about, if I could share what we were trying to achieve, what we stood for, if I could do that and then explain to each person how they can do their job in such a way that it serves the overall value proposition of the company, then I didn't have to tell them what to do. So, do not go astray, continuing to have the illicit affair she desires, actually turning to her ways. Al-Satak. Do not habitually, and when I say habitually, you know that it had to be written in the imperfect. Do not habitually wander away. You know, all of us spend some time wandering away. We were all part of that illicit affair. It just says don't do it on an ongoing basis. The moment you stop, you're good to go. So just don't do it on an ongoing basis.
Obviously, otherwise these words wouldn't matter. Nobody's expecting that we were perfect. They were what y'all was laying out there is the opportunity of choice for us.
Right.
This
was not written in the perfect. It was written in the imperfect.
Right. We were all brainwashed. We were all idiots. I mean, that's the
truth.
Just
don't continue to have an illicit affair that the whore desires, that the church desires, that Christianity desires, and don't actually turn to her ways over and over again. Your heart, your disposition, your inclinations and reasoning, your love. Boy, I'll tell you what, JB, I am so glad that you did that study on love. I've subsequently followed up on it, and you're absolutely right that the lab was the seat of reason. It's the place where you didn't just process information and form conclusions. It's the place where you took those conclusions to heart so that they became literally part of your life. They changed who you were. Like Larry, you said you had an entirely different perspective, an entirely different approach. When you take the conclusions that you can draw from Yahweh's testimony to heart, it changes everything about you. You become entirely different person.
You and I both know that all of us know that your perspective changes as soon as you see the truth. I mean, it's just a different perspective. All we're trying to do is share the truth.
Right.
I'm not even trying to convince them anymore.
Right. No, I don't either. Never. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Kirk earlier today, and I said, Kirk, have you ever persuaded anyone to become part of the covenant?
No.
No, never once. JB, ever persuaded anyone to be part of the covenant?
Nope.
No, and I know, Larry, you haven't either. You can't.
No, you just share the words.
Somebody.
I mean, they come to that themselves. I mean,
correct.
You know, and you know, you're talking about the lab here. I think somebody's got on a speakerphone, I'm not sure, but it seems like it to me from over here. What I would tell you is you get this in the military too. You know, you had you laid out this example of a commanding and control structure, which is absolutely true and relevant here. You know, whereas you know, one other thing, they have inculcated Christianity to a very large extent into the military. You know,
of course,
you go out there for God's country. I mean, think about this. You really do.
Visit Arlington National Cemetery and look at all the crosses.
Yeah,
they even misquote.
Did a commanding officer ever tell you that what I want you to do is I want you to take this to heart? I want you to not do what I tell you, but I really want you I want your attitude, your disposition, your inclination, and your reasoning. I'm really, really interested in what you take to heart. As opposed to
no.
Take this to heart. Do what I say.
That's
when
the
I
last
say
thing.
So
I want you to follow my words as though they were the word of God.
I want you to choose to respond, and the next words out of his love. And I want you to take this at heart. To heart.
And
can't be further from a command.
No, that's not how that works.
And you should not be continually deceived and wrongfully staggering into her popular lifestyle. Is there any religion in the human history that's as popular as Christianity?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
And you just said it permeates the military. It permeates our society.
Every facet of it.
Has become the lifestyle. The most popular
even these
lifestyle
phony bastard politicians. How do they end all their little speeches? No matter, whoever. God bless America.
When the two Republicans both dropped out of the race, all they wanted to talk about was the Lord is going to tell them their will for His will for their lives. And
who dropped out? I didn't even know. Who dropped out?
Kasich and Ted Cruz. They both dropped out. And when they both dropped out, all they wanted to talk about is the Lord revealing whatever it was going to be that was going to be the new will for their lives. And he introduced his old crippled mother as a clear leader.
Couldn't figure out what to do from 2 weeks ago.
And Bruce said that he wanted to thank his father for spreading the gospel from one end to the other end of the country.
Spell, huh? Thank you.
He's got a lot of people under God's spell.
He's saying here that the deceptions, the wrong doctrine of the Pauline satanic marriage is going to be popular. Boy.
And it's very popular.
Nothing has ever been more popular.
We're not very popular.
It's not just popular in America for Christians, but even the secularists in the West live in a Christian environment.
Yeah, and they think like them, too. Even though they claim
they
don't. They do. Yes, they do.
They do.
Absolutely,
yeah,
they do.
Yeah.
There's no right or wrong. Everything's a damn gray area with them.
Right.
And,
so
and
talking
you
about
everything.
The single most popular religion of all time. I think that God got that one right, too, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then he says, for many of the defiled and the deceased, she has victimized and brought down. And there are vast multitudes of apathetic individuals in addition to the powerful, all of whom have been deliberately destroyed and purposefully killed by her. You called Christianity a death cult because it's fixation on their God dying and their crucifix with the God dying. So
it is.
All Satan, if you look at Islam is a death cult.
That is too.
In Christianity, the God died for the faithful, and in Islam, the God died for God to kill for him. There, and of course, we all worship the same God. That's funny.
Well, they do.
They really do.
I don't worship any God.
If there's worship involved, it's not the Creator. He's a little bigger than that. Yeah.
So what Hasatan can do is two things. He can cause souls that have the capacity to live forever and be adopted into Yahweh's family and to enrich all of us and Yahweh as well with their presence. He can cause them to die by leading them astray. And Satan does that. That's a huge part of it.
And they do it out of free will. They do it out of free will.
Right. Right. And Hasatan can entice the likes of Paul to advocate satanic doctrine and spend eternity miserable, separated from God, reduced to a singularity. Those are the two things that Satan can do. And in the process, Satan can actually mock God just to try to make this whole experiment miserable for him. And of course, it's not going to work because God is thrilled just with the covenant members. And when he comes to deal with the non-covenant members, when he's actually going to engage, they're going to disappear so fast it's just going to make your head swim. And, you know, and that passage in Yahshayah that I've been translating, every religious artifact is going to be encased and ground to fine powder and then encased in volcanic rock. Just gone. It's all going to vanish. And so he's not going to be bothered by it. So Satan has done the best he can to create these death cults in Islam and Christianity. But it doesn't matter. Because all God would have been was happy just with Adam. That was content with that. That would have been enough for an enjoyable eternity. But he's going to get tens of thousands of us. It's even better. So, the whole purpose, though, of Satan is to have souls die. And then here's the last statement. It is the way. So, this death cult, to deliberately get powerful and apathetic individuals to die, it is the way of Shaul. So, doesn't Yahweh call Shaul the plague of death? This is that the way of Shaul is to get the apathetic and the powerful to die.
It is the way of Sheol. He can't be saying it's the way of Sheol. Shell's just a place. It doesn't have a way. It doesn't have a perspective, a thought process, or anything else. You know, it may well lead to Sheol, but it's a way of Sheol.
But when you think about it, though, in this particular case, it is the way to Sheol.
Vis-a-vis Sheol.
But it is the way of Sheol. Now, in a way, though, I'm going to backtrack for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Death is not the way to Sheol. I was wrong.
No.
The thing that comes before here is being deliberately destroyed and purposefully killed by her. It is the way to Sheol. No, it can't be. No one knows.
No, it's
Sheol.
The whole time we're talking about a male individual here.
So I'm going to tell you, I got that wrong. I wrote this. I translated it. It is the way of Sheol and to Sheol. But I can't write it that way. It's wrong.
No, you just have to say it's the way of Sheol. But
right.
It is
and the reason you have to say that is because death does not lead to
Sheol.
Sheol
doesn't. And he even calls it the plague of death.
What have you got to do? Change it back to Sheol?
I'm probably going to leave it the way it is, and then I'm going to explain what I've just said.
Okay.
The grammar here allows either translation.
Yeah, but most souls won't go to Sheol.
But then to say, yeah, I think that's the way that you do it. It's like putting those six or seven statements in Yah's voice and then explaining why that's wrong. Yeah, here's a viable translation. It's just that it's wrong for the following reasons. I think that's a healthier way to deal with it. Then it says descending into impending doom surrounding the lightless inner rooms of her house, the plague of death. So Sheol is, in fact, a place where one goes into the impending doom of a lightless room. That part is correct.
Yeah, but it's surrounding.
And by the way, part of Sheol, the way of Sheol, the way of the whore, is that, you know, it said both the powerful and the apathetic. There are both are acceptable in the sense of some, the leaders, the proponents, the perpetuators. They're going to go into the lightless rooms of Sheol.
Oh yes,
and the apathetic are going to die. It's the plague of death for the apathetic. And for the victims, and it is a lightless room for the
Leaders. For their leaders, sure. Of course, yeah, because there is justice.
There's,
you know.
But once again, the way of Sheol is the plague of death. That's how it is.
I just don't understand.
The way of Sheol is the plague of death.
You know, their lack of understanding gets them there. I mean, could you imagine? It'd be one thing walking up and saying, I was adult, I was an idiot, and Yahweh says, get away from me. Okay, I have no more further need for you. That's another thing. He says to most of these people, right, I have no further need from you. In other words, they're not going to get eternal separation. They're done. They're done.
Right.
It's one thing to know you're walking into nothingness. You know, you're just dead. You know, that's not even hateful. Really, it's very decent of him. But it's another thing to be eternally separated forever. I hope they think they're enjoying a good time now, because the first 10 seconds in there is they're just going to go, why did I do what I did? You know?
Now, I'm going to, just a couple of program notes here. What I'm currently doing is I've reordered two chapters, and I'm halfway through reordering a third. So that I've come up with a format. You all know IQ Arasuli. He was the one that proposed this format, and so far the feedback I have received on it is really favorable, plus I really like it. It's just a lot of work to do it this way. It's much more work to do it this way because of the way that I write. But what I'm doing is rewriting these chapters so that a summation without the Hebrew in a less amplified, little more liberal, a little less literal translation, so that it reads as it was intended in English. You know, just, so I'll reorder the I'll get the subject before the verb and the object after the verb, and just make it so that it's easier to understand what's being said. And I'll take whatever discussion I'm going to have in that page break area, you know, usually about 10 pages, and I take a less amplified, no Hebrew words, easier to understand, all of the passages that we're going to view over the next, say, 10 to 15 pages, and I put them all up front and say, okay, here's what we're going to talk about. And then after doing it, going to each statement and do that surgical analysis where we examine every word. We put the Hebrew word in there. We put the stems, the moods, the conjugation. Everything is there for analysis, and then all of the detailed analysis even after we've done the amplified version. So rather than following it, it's now going in front of it.
That sounds like a good format.
Yeah, I think I've sent you some of this stuff. When you have some time, read it. I think it just makes it easier to understand, and particularly for those who may start with observations and don't have 10 years invested with us. I think it's easier to understand than the old method was, where the summations came after the detailed analysis. So I'm doing that. And then I'm going to go back and do chapters 1 through 4. And then after that, and we've got everybody's input, then we're going to, I've went and bought the URL for observationsforourtime.com. So we have the URL, and we're going to post these once I've done the read-through, this edit pass, and gotten everything reordered that way. That's kind of where we are. And then the URL is my website, web address. So we did get for this observationsforourtime.com. So it'll be posted there. Now, the other thing is that the eighth chapter is not going to be a continuation of Yashayahu. The ninth chapter will be. But the eighth chapter is going to deal with Yahweh's discussion with Dodd and later with Solomon regarding Zion. So we have a more clear, more comprehensive understanding that Zion and Moriah are coterminous. Zion is simply the signs that are posted on the three levels of
Moriah.
Moriah exists of three extremely important sites: the city of Dodd, the Temple Mount, and the summit of the mountain where he met with Abraham and where he himself fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bekorah. And each of those three are part of the signs that he has posted along the way, and they're all on Moriah.
You know,
But there's so many interesting things that that are part of the conversations between Yahweh and Dodd, and Yahweh and Solomon. And there's one with Solomon where God says, "Hey, what do you want?" And so Solomon gives him what he wants, and God's so impressed with his answer, says, "Yeah, I'm going to give you what you asked for." You know, that was a want list. He gave him a really good answer, and God said, "I'm going to give you what you want." And so I want to share that conversation. And then I had always thought that mistakenly that the reason that Dodd was not allowed to build the temple is because God was not pleased that he had his general killed so that he could commit adultery with his general's wife, Bathsheba. But that wasn't it. Wasn't it at all. God explains. Tells Dodd exactly why he can't build the temple.
Yeah, because God, he was a military guy.
Exactly right. He's a man. You're a man of war. And no man of war is going to build my home for life.
You know, that goes right back to his symbols, you know, the dove.
Right.
No wonder the religious types don't like that one being brought up
Yeah, well, the,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's
right.
Warriors,
yeah,
how
hard
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 is that when you're sitting around
yeah,
fighting in the military?
Group,
all
said, no, you're not going to build my temple because it's not going to be built by Man of War. This is not a victory celebration, a tribute, a monument to military conquest. That is not what this is about. You're a man of war, so no, you're not building my house. So I thought that was powerful. So I'm going to devote a whole chapter to these discussions that I found interesting between Yahwa and Solomon and Dode, and then we're going to return to the third chapter of Yashaya as we progress. So that's kind of the plan. Now, in terms of this program and observations, we have at the end of this chapter a chapter 1 and chapter 2 review of Chabaouk. And it's one of the most detailed prophecies in the whole of the Torah, Nabi and Mizmor. So we'll devote whatever amount of time it takes us to get
through it right now, or at least
so
what I've got.
Next week? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. It's very, you know, I've always said that, you know, I mean, I've said this since I saw it, you know, some of the descriptions of Christianity, laying it out,
uh-huh.
even in Daniel, where he says that the beast is going to be, you know, a Pauline Christian, and on and on.
Yeah.
These prophecies are so powerful and so amazing, and they're laid out in front of people that have been sufficiently fooled to where they
right.
cannot even see them.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing how detailed God is in his condemnation of Paul and of Roman Catholicism, which is the basis of Christianity. Really detailed. I mean, when he goes in, you look at the how the revelation summation of the whore of Babylon ties directly to Imperial Rome.
Yeah, well, you did that last week. You're talking about with the one has left. This was just the demon that had Sheol, you know. And went back, and you know, then you've got the emperors, and then you've got one still to come, and you lay them all out. You can name them. You say, wow, you know, I'd never considered that. I don't know if you guys had.
I'd never heard it, and then you just look at it and says, okay, he's obviously speaking to Rome, the city on seven hills, and it's obviously he's putting all of this in the context of the Daniel prophecy, so it's obviously something growing out of Rome, and he said, okay, you got five that are gone. One that is, but will not be. And then one that will come and is going to linger. And you just look up, okay, Roman emperors. There's five that were deceased.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one that currently was alive. And he wouldn't be alive very much longer. And then there was one that not only came and lingered, Vespasian, but where did he come? He came to Yehuda.
Yeah, and what's your position? What's your position now on Macedonia? Is that still your position there?
Well, you know, when you read the Daniel's depiction of where the Torahless One is going to come, it has to be the intersection of the Roman Empire and Alexander the Great's empire. Has to be the intersection of those two. And Alexander the Great never made it. The furthest he went west was Macedonia, so he never made it to what we consider Italy today. So it cannot. He cannot come from Rome. And then we're also given the clue as to those that destroy the temple. And you have three legions. And if you look at where those legions, one of the legions was actually called the Macedonian.
Really?
And the other two legions were actually the troops that were part of the of those legions came from Macedonia, and so we tie it all together. But then it has so many other requirements. One is that it has to be a relatively new country. Well, Greece is not a new country, and Italy is not a new country, but Macedonia is. has to be
longer. Yeah, plus you've got the situation too where the false prophet is throwing his weight behind the beast.
Right, and it has to be a
Pauline Christian.
So it can't be Turkey, not a new country. It can't be Italy, can't be Greece. These are old countries. And it has to be a small country. So it can't be a country with a population like Italy or Greece or Turkey. They're not small in population. They're not small in geography. Macedonia is tiny in population. It's tiny in geography, and it's a new country. And so, are there some other Balkan countries but the evidence is so overwhelming for Macedonia that I'd be shocked if it's not Macedonia. Could it be another one of those countries where you have an overlap between the Roman Empire and the Greek Empire? Yeah, but. Boy, I tell you what, I think that
one of the legions was called Macedonia. Tells me something.
And of course, in that chapter, I went through all of the other alternatives and said, well, this is why I wouldn't go there.
What does Macedonia mean, by the way? Do you know, right off the top?
No, it's what the new country of Macedonia did, and it really upset the Greeks no end. In fact, the Greeks don't even want Macedonia to be part of the EU because they took the name Macedonia, and of course the Greeks think, well, you know, Alexander was Alexander of Macedon. That the Greek Empire was a Macedonian Empire, and for them to take the Macedonian name really upset them. But it's a Greek name. So it's not Hebrew. So it wouldn't mean anything to us in terms of God. But if you look at their symbols, for example, their flag is a rising sun.
Yeah.
Their national anthem speaks of the reverence for the sun.
Just in a quick Google search, Macedonia means burning adoration.
Well, there you go.
Well, for the new guy coming, the tallest one, of course.
Well, no, I mean he likes being pretty out front, like this rising sun, like the flag that's a rising sun, name meaning the arrogant sun of the morning rising sun. You know, these are all just a look at me. You know, I think that's part of the laugh that he gets on mankind. Look how obvious I am, and look how stupid they are. Kind of thing,
right?
You know,
I mean, yeah, in fact, I forgot that one of the passages that we covered today on observations, and was talking about the whore, and the descriptive word used to describe the whore was Shakar.
Yeah, Satan's lovely.
Last name. Yeah, Satan's last name, Shakar.
Yeah,
right there in the text.
You know, you can show this stuff. You understand? You can show them. You know, here is why you're worshiping a Lord on Sunday, and that Baal was Lord, and Bible means this, and this, and this. And you can show this to them, and these people will say, and they have said this to me dozens and dozens of times, you're twisting words.
I'm telling you what they mean.
I'm straight up showing you words. I don't have to trust anything.
And by the way, they can mean many things. We're going to even tell you all the many things they can mean. If we're going to provide a translation, we're going to say, while this word can mean all these different things, these are the meanings that fit. And they fit the context. So here's what they mean.
It's just astounding how blind people are. It's just stupid. It's why... Let me tell you something. I take phone calls all the time, you know, and I take messages, you know, because people leave messages on my phone at 3 a.m. looking for an engine, if you can believe that. And you pick, this happens all the time. And I pick them up and I start writing the messages down. And you know what people say to me today? You guys are going to be astounded by this. They'll say my area code is 52632. They'll give you their zip code. And they call it their area code. People today, and I'm telling you more than half of them, don't know the difference between a area code and a zip code.
Well,
that's what you're dealing with out there. You better believe
it. We are in an extraordinarily stupid period. We spent the first 20 minutes or so of observation today just observing how stupid people have become. You know,
well, they can tell them anything. They can tell them they can tell them we're giving five. First of all, they'll show all these atrocities of babies being raped and bitten half and murdered and butchered. And they say, now we're giving $500 million to the, quote, Syrian rebels.
Right.
You know? You know, remember that the day that happened, we were on Chattering Mess. I was saying, I kept scratching my head. How do you fund ISIS? Why you fight ISIS?
Why you're bombing?
And you kept going, I hear you. I'm hearing you. This is insane. And it is insane. It's gotten so stupid. You know what the Pope came out with this week, don't you?
No.
That it's a great thing that all the Muslims are being herded into European countries. You know why? It promotes one world unity.
Oh, great.
And I thought, boy, that's Babylon, isn't it?
That's Babylon.
Perfect.
Right. Exactly what we'd expect. Exactly what we'd expect from the Pope at this time.
And that's exactly what he said.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
we're
going to
lower your standards of living.
We're going to have, as sure as we're talking here, the Torahless one is going to have a Muslim father, a Christian mother, and he's going to go to a secular humanist institution. I mean, it's exactly like Barack Obama, except Barack Obama is not the Torahless one. Well, Barack Obama is Torahless for sure, but he is not the Torahless one. But,
no, he's too incompetent. He's too incompetent.
But that's exactly what we're going to see is this not only unification, but the unification, the Torahless one, is going to be the spitting image of Paul. He's going to impose Christianity.
Going to be loved. They're going to love him.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm just saying those statements like that, they come out and they go, yeah, and then this promotes one world unity. Okay, so let's see. We purposely go out and we decimate these countries. Now, let's say I'm in one of those countries and I grew up a moron. I'm going to grab my suitcase and I'm going to get the hell out of there, too. And
the only statement that I am aware that Yosha repeated three times is, I did not come to bring peace or unity. I came to bring division.
Division.
And it's the only statement that I'm aware of that he repeats three times. I did not come to bring unity or peace or one world to bring us all together. I came to bring division.
So here you are,
you're pretending to be the vicar
of
Christ on earth, and you're saying this is good because it brings one world government. When Yahweh condemned government, and Yosha said, I didn't come to unify you. And, you know, of course, what is the first requirement of the covenant?
Walk away from all of them.
Right, walk away. It's not to be unified with them, to walk away from them.
Well, you know,
that's what I
say.
There is nobody more disgusting on planet Earth today than the Pope, the single most repulsive human alive today.
But you've got a propaganda tool that won't quit. What does the average person think? Well, they've turned on
the
TV during the Christmas year, and it said, "Let's watch the show about the quote Prince of Peace." Right?
You know,
right?
We've heard about Gog.
Yes.
You know what the Pope's name is?
Yeah, it is Gog, isn't it?
Yeah, for Gog.
Yeah, you said that. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. He is Bergoglio.
The insanity of all this has just gotten, I mean, there's signs everywhere. There's posts everywhere. I am not going to attack particularly the prime ministers of Yisrael. I know in the end, Israel
I'm not either. I think, in fact, if I were
But when
to,
I see a guy with a name like Benjamin, now, when I see a guy with a name like Benjamin, and I've seen him playing on the world stage, I wonder if he's one of the actors, too. I know it's hard to buy.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah, I am. I can tell you that Bergoglio is a player in the last days. He's a major player. He's a proponent of socialist secular humanism, a proponent of one world government, a proponent of Islam, of the unification of religions. He is a major player in the demise of the world. So while he is not the false prophet, because the false prophet has to be from the land, he is certainly going to play a major role in ushering in the Torahless one.
Somebody has to okay the, where he takes over three countries and then 10. I mean, somebody's going to be pulling.
Yes, yeah, someone's going to stand behind it, and of course that's yeah. That's one where we're
going to
get unification, right? Yeah, unification.
Yeah.
And of course that's going to happen out of economic collapse and out of economic chaos. You know.
I saw a post the other day where the world owes $40 trillion or something, and the question after that was to who? Jupiter? You know.
Yeah, of course, what's interesting now is that the majority of American debt is held by the Fed.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It wasn't Larry getting a bunch of money handed to him. I can tell you that. You know,
once you pay the Fed, you ain't going to pay it. I mean,
yeah,
they never put up any money anyway.
They did was tell the presses
to run.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, it's so bad what they've done.
They don't even run the presses anymore. It's all digital.
I made that mistake and said you got to print paper, and you said, no, you don't. You just change the number on a screen. I thought, I stand corrected.
Right.
So,
I mean, the point is they never had anything of value that they often put in the pie.
No, they didn't.
It's all just a scam. It was all
That's why making a quarter of a percent interest on money that you don't have, pretty good deal.
Yeah, that's a tremendous.
You know, if you want to pay me a quarter of a percent interest on $1 billion
that I don't have,
that sounds like that I don't have, but you can pay it to me anyway. That's a pretty good deal. Yeah, you know, you said that the world's $20 trillion in debt. Half of it's the United States.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like our military. Our military is larger than the rest of the world's combined, and our debt is. Is half of the world's debt. We represent, 4% of the world's population, and we have 50% of its debt? Yeah, sure, we're a prosperous country.
Well, we keep giving it to them to buy
them all.
You
know, I think when you talk about, you know, Bernie Sanders wants to redistribute the wealth, why not,
redistribute the debt? Okay. I'm going to hide it if you want to be Australia. How about you, Italy?
Yeah. You know, what I want to do is I want to be part of the under 40, highly educated, that are voting for Bernie Sanders, that is creating class warfare and has this great solution for a fair, more prosperous economy, and he's never worked a day in his life in a job.
Perfect. I'm not sure hardly any of these people have.
No, I mean, that's when you've gone full retard. I mean, you don't even have to be. Yeah, you don't have to.
Retard. How would you like to be? Jeb Bush came out today and said, "I'm not going to vote for Obama." So, why would anybody care? I mean, you spent $25 billion running for president, and you didn't get any votes, didn't win anything. I mean, you came in dead last, and so we didn't care what you had to say. Why would we care how you vote? And you've got Paul Ryan coming out the next day that Trump is now the presumptive nominee, which means he's head of the Republican Party. And you say, you know, I'm not going to support him.
I think the follow up line, Terry said the follow up line was that Trump said, I don't want him anyway.
No, what actually Trump said was brilliant. What Trump said is that because he said, you know, I'm not ready to endorse him. And then when Trump came back and said, I am not ready to endorse the speaker's agenda. Until the speaker can show me that his agenda is in the best interest of the American people. Because up to this point, the elitists in Washington have abused the American people, and it's time that we put the American people first. So I'm not ready to support the speaker's agenda.
Well, good for him.
He got eaten up alive and spit out for yesterday's sausage.
It's going to be fun. I hope he gets it just because it's going to be fun to watch it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. He is the presumptive nominee, so he's going to be the Republican candidate. And what's going to be interesting is it takes $1 billion to run. Trump doesn't have $1 billion to spend, so he has to raise money. And so how is he going to raise the $1 billion to run negative ads against Hillary, which is what you have to do to be a viable candidate. How's he going to do that? And is the Republican Party going to disintegrate in the process? Is it literally going to disintegrate, which, you know, by all, you know, appearances right now, it is disintegrating. Whether he wins or loses, the Republican Party is disintegrating. So,
and that may be the point of it. That may be the point of the whole act. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's all an act anyway. I mean, you know, these things are done very purposely. It's just sort of like you remember finding out that they intended to destroy Syria long before they ever did it.
The CIA had a specific plan to destroy Syria. Long before the Arab Spring ever commenced, and all the despicable things we're doing is exactly part of that plan, and yet no one gives a hoot. Oh, yeah, we're gonna go after ISIS.
So now, you know, you got the Pope saying, well, see, this is a good thing, you know, that they're all being ran into these Western countries. It's a very good thing because it promotes one world unity. I mean,
why don't you turn your Catholic churches into mosques, and that'll be really good.
One or a half dozen of another anyway. The Inquisition's on its way, and the Inquisition was no better.
Thinking America, you've got the Democratic Party disintegrating because you have a guy who's not a Democrat, not a member of the Democratic Party, who is an independent, who is just beating up Hillary as a communist. And so the Democratic Party is literally falling apart, and the Republican Party is self-destructing.
Well, I guess we're going to wind up with a dictator, ain't we?
Wow, we are really got front row seats to...
Apocalypse. Yeah, you know, and it's not going to be a funny thing when they crash it and all that, because everything that people are used to, they're just not going to have.
I know. It's going to crash big time and hard.
No, I know, and it's a sad thing. I mean, today I can get up and work. You know, you know, you can go do whatever you do retired. But, you know, when suddenly all that paper becomes worthless.
We're a credit-based society, and the credit's going to fall apart. The whole credit system is going to collapse.
And you can't borrow money, you can't run business.
Well, it's not just borrow money. It's your electronic money is going to cease to be effective. No credit card's going to be viable. You won't be able to, take your physical money out of the bank. No one's going to take physical money. You won't be able to get your physical money. And it's debt anyway. It's a liability. And your credit instruments are not going to work.
Do you think that the banks are going to pull that in the next few years?
Well, it is not in their interest to pull it. But there is inevitable because of the fact that that any spooking of the economy is going to cause people to want to withdraw capital. And of our credit economy, capital only represents, actual physical bills only represent like 0.1% of the money. It can't be printed or distributed fast enough to deal with that, and as a result, it's going to collapse. Mm-hmm. When you can't get your money out of the bank, and they have to shut down the credit system because there's no way to create the illusion that it has any viability under that collapsing system, and it's all going to it's going to spiral down in a weekend.
Well, when it's in the best interest. Of those who want to consolidate power out of chaos, it'll be done. It'll be done.
Yeah.
I mean, the stories will be put out. Whatever needs to be put out will be put out.
Those who know what's happening, the very few who know what's happening and are willing to speak out will be silenced. So
will be. You know, it's kind of a strange thing. You know, if you're on social media, what you see is every day they got a new date where everything's going to come to an end. The collapse is going to take place, or this month, or this meeting's happening, it's over with. And, of course, this has went on for years, so it should have happened, 10 years ago.
October 2nd, 2033.
Yeah, this. Yeah, that's what.
6:22 p.m. Mark it down.
Write that one down.
I hope you live to see it.
I'm not
going to live to see it. Not.
No, I hope once you're taken out and you come back and see it.
Yeah, I'm gonna be. We're all gonna be long gone.
Yeah.
But
no, we'll be alive.
We'll be alive, but not here. Well, we actually.
But you gotta know.
We are invited to attend the return.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and Yashiyahu talks about all the wealthy countries just, you know, roaring like a flood, you know, when it all collapses. I mean, that's what he talks about. I think it happens right around the Teruah date.
There is an amazing thing that there's so much rhetoric about the merchants at the end.
Yep. They're screaming.
If you spend, and it only took me like an hour to figure out who the merchants of Tarshish are and their ships and who it was at the time and who it is now. You know, it's really easy to figure this stuff out.
Well, who was it at the time?
It was the Punic Empire, the Carthaginians were Tarshish. There's actually a city that they controlled on the island of Sardinia that bears the name, but the Carthaginians were Phoenicians. The Punic Empire, the Carthaginian Empire, is a Phoenician empire. But Carthage was not only in every detail. I mean, I went through the entire thing, everything Yahweh has to say about Tarshish, and every aspect of it. They had a monopoly on metal trade, and they had a monopoly on worldwide trade. They had a total exclusive from running all the way from the British Islands all the way down to on the north, all the way down to Nigeria on the south, and everything in the Mediterranean with their navy. And they used their navy to give them this monopoly on trade. But Tarshish is the Carthaginian Empire, and every detail of it fits God's description of it. But it's the ships of Tarshish that are destroyed in the last days. And so you have to figure out, so he's telling you who Tarshish was, what is symbolic of
them.
So I went through, what are the characteristics of Tarshish, the first country in the history of the world to base an economic empire based on its naval presence, the first to come up with a coinage monetary system. And you go through all of the aspects of Tarshish and what they're like. There's only one country in the world today that's a mirror of Tarshish.
Want me to take a stab at that one?
USA.
Yes. You got it. That's Tarshish. We are the Tarshish of the traders, the Tarshish with the navy and the shipping, the merchants. We are.
Well, I mean, these days, like they say, my perspective is changed, and I see these damn commercials where they're talking about, and we are the U.S. Navy. We're out here protecting your freedom. You know, you're free because
of course for good.
Sitting there going, wow, really?
Yeah,
you're out here floating around in the med, so I'm free over here. What nonsense. It sounds like
the military, get the Navy over here and start watching our ports. Then they'll be protecting us.
Well, let's just say that they were to return to our ports. Who's going to invade the port of Los Angeles?
No, don't even worry about it. They're going to need them on their
Baltimore Harbor. Who are they going to keep from invading Baltimore Harbor? Won't you tell me what nation over the course of the next 20 years, not even just now, over the next 20 years, could build a navy such that they could project a force so they could invade through Baltimore Harbor and occupy the country? No one.
No, we need to bring them home.
They
watch
they would
for
be protected
being smuggled in.
Yeah.
Get rid of the ships and just put them to work looking and observing the cargo.
But even then, it wouldn't do any good. No, it's just, if you eliminated the military, we'd be freer and safer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, eliminate
without a doubt.
completely go to a zero military would be freer and safer. Instantly. It is a, but that's one of the sick things about Trump is he wants to vastly increase
grow the military.
Yeah.
He thinks we don't have enough military. We don't have enough.
That's right. What's going on?
We don't have a good enough one.
Yeah, we don't have enough military.
What do you want?
Yeah, the basis is because we can't defeat ISIS that we don't have a big enough military.
Well, we might want to stop funding them. That might be step one.
Arming them and arming the Sauds who are arming them and arming the Qataris who are arming them.
Liberating
all the money for their for Hezbollah to Iran. Yeah, there's a lot of things we could do that would. If we just stopped being the merchants of death, stop selling military hardware, shut down our military, and stop buying oil from the Islamic terrorists, it would all go away.
We don't even need the oil. We've got enough pumping now.
Right.
One of the sad things you see a lot of patriotism out here. I see less and less of it because I block more and more of it. But, you know, the people that produce these advance these concepts.
Yeah, you're a big naval base. A big naval base. And Air Force base.
Biggest on the East Coast today.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I'm not talking about out here in my neighborhood. I'm talking more about on social media. But see people constantly with the God Bless America routine and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you really think that God's blessing a country that hates him, completely opposed to him, stands against, he says, hoy, I mean, that ain't a good thing. On and on, and you really believe this, but that is how indoctrinated people are. You could never talk them out of it.
So we've got the blessing of half the world's debt. That's a hell of a blessing, isn't it?
Yeah, and we owe Jupiter, for God's sake.
Yeah, I don't know that much.
The world owes $40 trillion.
Speaking of oil, how much oil do you think we would save if we got rid of all of our war machines?
Oh, tons.
How many gallons of oil get used for our military fleet?
Well, you know, we could have public transportation. There were ways to stop all this stuff, but, you know, that ain't what they chose to do.
That is not what they chose to do.
No.
No, it was an easy fix. Everything that ails us. But now, thanks to political correctness, there are not enough smart people that are judgmental around it that you could never explain the fix in a way that would resonate with enough people.
No.
We're way too far gone.
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is most people just don't care. I mean, they don't care one way or another. I mean, look, I was involved in politics. I know you were involved in politics. I mean, you don't get 4 hours time in the White House because you weren't considered in the upper echelon of the Republican Party. What I do know for sure and certain is that the people that you think are grassroots that would be the most informed and all this, they're not. They're nearly retarded.
No.
They're stupid. On so many levels.
You know, I was talking about observations today, Larry, and said, you know, that the Wolf Blitzer had the first interview with Trump after he became the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. And Wolf Blitzer, his big point was, you know, here's all of these career politicians that have spent their entire life, that Republicans had 17 people that ran for president, the deepest and probably the highest quality group of candidates in the history of the Republican Party, and here's a guy with absolutely no political experience whatsoever that just trounces them, and Wolf Blitzer couldn't understand it. How is that possible that this guy who had no political experience whatsoever can beat all of these career politicians? And Trump did not have the answer, and the answer is obvious, and Trump should know the answer. It just amazes me that people can't think. But the answer is America's worst engage in politics, not America's best.
Yeah, that would have been my answer. The answer is that
Bernie and
have destroyed
Obama
the country.
Never succeeded at anything in their lives. America's worst engage in politics. You know, a washed-up B actor, Ronald Reagan, is the best the Republicans can tout. The worst engage in politics. George Bush was a complete failure at everything he did in his life. The worst engage in politics. if you are very driven, talented, bright, willing to make personal sacrifices to achieve something, you're a builder. You're going to engage in business.
You have no interest
America's
in politics.
America's best and brightest work in business. Always have. America's best and brightest are not part of any political machine. They're not part of any military operation. They're not part of any religious institution. They are not part of any academic institution. The best and the brightest, the most qualified, by far, are in business.
That's the term.
A decent businessman trounced the politicians.
No, I know that. But, I mean, yeah, you have to be a genius to be a truck driver today, for God's sakes. I mean, really, you know. No, really. I'm just saying, you know, there's people out here that are creating, they're producing all the time, and these are the smartest people out there. There's no question about it. I mean, every political actor, no matter who they're standing in front of, it could be teachers, it could be military men, it could be whoever. They're always the best and the brightest. Everybody's the best and the brightest. Well, here's news, folks. Not everybody can be the best nor the brightest. Not everybody.
The fact is that business centers are the closest thing you have to those who are the most effective in the world today, and certainly in this country. And that's why a businessman trounces the politicians.
Don't people always vote for economic reasons, though, on general elections? I mean, unless there's something really pending. I mean, they're always going to look at it. I mean, when you have a lousy economy, people are always going to vote to have a better economy. And
the rich, it sounds appealing, and I'm going to give the money to you. That's going to be the Bernie and the Hillary approach. Or the Trump approach is, I'm going to empower business to be more effective and to create, to do better. You know, and Trump can't even say, you know, countries or businesses are moving out of the country, we're going to stop that. Well, there's a way that you stop it. And the way that you stop it,
you lower the tax,
not by force, not by penalty, no force. You simply create an environment where it is more economically desirable for them to stay here. And so you do two things.
Incentive.
One is you lower their taxes, you lower their you diminish regulations, and you lower taxes, reduce the burden placed on business. And then the second thing that you do is that if on imported goods you increase the duties.
Sure.
You increase the duties on imported goods, and you reduce the burdens on domestic manufacturing. It's extremely simple.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
A five-year-old can figure it out.
Well, of course. Yeah.
Well, it's got to be a motive.
You incentivize what you want more of, and you disincentivize what you want less of. But we take the opposite approach. That, you know, the Hillary Sanders approach is that you tax, you disincentivize business, you incentivize dependency. It's just stupid. And people vote for that. Yeah, you can't have a rational conversation with them. Anyway, fellas, we'll do Chabauk when we gather again at this time. Chabauk is that's fun stuff, man. I just love the line.
Sounds like a plan.
God, you can't die.
You can't die.
Well, there goes Christianity right there.
Well, who is this idiot? You can't die? Why are you making me look at this?
You know. On a serious note, though, I just want to throw this out there. You throw out. We're showing people concepts like the fact Yah was not a religious deity. There's no prayer. There's no worship in the Torah. There's God's not omnipresent. On and on and on. He has a name. He wants you to use it. It's not sacred. We're unveiling right before people's eyes.
Right.
Prophecy about Christianity and the inventor of Christianity. This is what we were doing tonight. And there's a couple hundred people listening. Hundred people listening at most.
Right.
It's just an insane.
The average show that we do here, we have If you look at the tracking, it may be just about 1,000 listens.
Oh, we have 1,000.
Yeah, because 90% of it's the archives.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah,
but either way, I mean, you've got 8 billion people or 6 billion people.
It's not the chat room. So you have about what you would expect.
Yeah,
I would not expect anymore.
Point of yellow's numbers. That's it.
Yeah, that's exactly what you would. That's what you would hope for. That's what you would expect. And by the way, if it was just the 4 or 5 of us, I'd do it. I'd happen to dearly love Doe down in New Zealand. We just have a lot in common. I'd do it if it was just he and I.
He's a buddy.
You and I, Larry. I'd do it. I'd do it just the two of us. I'd do it if it was just Kirk, you and me. I'd do it, James. We've had long conversations. I'd do it just the two of us.
Yeah, Mr. Kiwi and I, we engage every, we're on each other's page every day pretty much anymore, And he's got a great sense of humor.
I enjoy Roy down there in the land of Oz.
Well, I don't know Roy. I mean, I have never engaged with him. So
I've gotten
really
to know Roy pretty well because of the fact that the last 10 pages or so of chapter 7 of observations is a very scientific overview of our composition, particularly Nefesh and Nesoma. And so I'll write something, have Roy edit it, then I'll have Roy write something and I'll edit it, and we'll end up with a combination because the guy is really smart when it comes to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's really smart. So it's fun to bounce ideas off of. He doesn't think of himself as smart. He just thinks of himself as somebody who is fascinated by and willing to think about and open to trying to come up with answers to the things that nobody else wants to think about. And he has the perspective of the covenant, which makes us all hugely more efficient in terms of our thinking than the other one.
It's a nice advantage.
But I enjoy him. I really enjoy him. I just think he's just fun. It's no ego involved. Just here's some things to think of and ways.
Oh, you can't. You can't involve yourself in ego when you do this stuff. I mean, if you start doing that, then you're just going to become a Paul kind of idiot.
That's right. You don't.
When
you
people,
can be opposed, I have a pride that is significant as it relates to I'm proud to be part of the covenant. I'm proud to call you guys my friends within the covenant. I'm proud of what we've accomplished in terms of getting to know Yahweh and sharing what we have learned. There is a sense of a pride that comes with being part of the covenant, but none of it is individual pride.
Yes.
It's collective pride. I mean, I think God is quite proud of what he is offering, what he has done. I think he's proud of his family. And so I think there is a pride that is appropriate. But it's collective covenant pride and understanding pride, not in persona.
I've made people angry by telling them that loved ones that they are trying to hold up because they said Yahweh once or something are not covenant and they don't understand or know Yahweh, because they still promote pagan belief systems and everything else.
Yeah.
I've had people go through the roof and accuse me of being, who are you? You're like, and I say, no, I'm just looking at Yahweh's words, and I'm nothing like a preacher. I involve myself